On March 16, 1943, Oppie and Kitty boarded a train bound for Santa Fe, a sleepy town of 20,000 people. They checked into La Fonda, the best hotel in town, where Oppenheimer spent a few days recruiting people to run a Santa Fe liaison office for the laboratory. One day, Dorothy Skerritt McKibben, a 45-year-old Smith College graduate, was standing in the lobby of La Fonda, waiting to be interviewed for a job she had been told nothing about. "I saw a man walking on the balls of his feet and garbed in a trench coat and pork pie hat," McKibben said. Oppenheimer introduced himself as Mr. Bradley and asked about her background. Widowed 12 years earlier, McKibben had first moved to New Mexico to cure a mild case of tuberculosis and, like Oppenheimer, had fallen in love with the stark beauty of the place. By 1943, McKibben knew everyone there was to know in Santa Fe society, including such artists and writers as the poet Peggy Pond Church, the watercolorist Katie Wells, and the architect John Gaw Meem. She was also a friend of the dancer and choreographer Martha Graham, who spent her summers in New Mexico during the late 1930s. Oppenheimer could see that this sophisticated, well-connected, and self-confident woman would not be easily intimidated, and when he realized that McKibben knew Santa Fe and its environs better than he did, he hired her to run a discreet office at 109 East Palace Avenue in the downtown area. McKibben was immediately smitten by Oppenheimer's easy grace and charming manners. "I knew that anything he was connected with would be alive," she recalled, "and I made my decision. I thought to be associated with that person, whoever he was, would be simply great. I never met a person with a magnetism that hit you so fast and so completely as his did. I didn't know what he did. I thought maybe if he were digging trenches to put in a new road, I would love to do that. I just wanted to be allied and have something to do with a person of such vitality and radiant force. That was for me." McKibben may have had no idea what Oppenheimer was doing, but she nevertheless soon became the gatekeeper to Los Alamos. From her unmarked office, she greeted hundreds of scientists and their families bound for the Hill. Some days she fielded 100 phone calls and issued dozens of passes. She would come to know everyone and everything about the new community, but it took her a year to figure out that they were building an atomic bomb. McKibben and Oppenheimer were to become lifelong friends. Robert called her by her nickname, Dink, and quickly learned to rely on her good judgment and her ability to get things done. At 39, Oppenheimer seemed not to have aged in 20 years. He still had long, very black and crinkly hair that stood nearly straight up. "He had the bluest eyes I've ever seen," McKibben said. "Very clear blue." They reminded her of the pale, icy blue color of gentians, a wildflower that grew on the slopes of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. The eyes were mesmerizing. They were large and round and guarded by heavy eyelashes and thick black eyebrows. He always looked at the person he was talking to. He always gave everything he could to the person he was talking to. He still spoke very softly, and though he could talk with great erudition about almost anything, he could still seem charmingly boyish. When he was impressed with something, McKibben later recalled, he'd say, "Gee," and it was just lovely to hear him say, "Gee." Robert's collection of admirers was growing exponentially at Los Alamos. By the end of the month, Robert, Kitty, and Peter moved up to The Hill and settled into their new home, a rustic one-story log and stone house built in 1929 for May Connell, the sister of the ranch school's director and an artist who served as matron for the ranch school boys. Master's Cottage No. 2 sat at the end of Bathtub Row, named with impeccable logic because it and five other log homes from the ranch school period were the only houses on the mesa equipped with bathtubs. Located on a quiet, unpaved street in the middle of the new community, the Oppenheimer home was partially shielded by shrubbery and boasted a small garden. With two tiny bedrooms and a study, the house was modest compared to One Eagle Hill. Because the schoolmasters had taken all their meals in the school cafeteria, the house lacked a kitchen, a drawback soon rectified at Kitty's insistence. But its living room was pleasant, with high ceilings, a stone fireplace, and an enormous plate-glass window overlooking the garden. It would be their home until the end of 1945. That first spring in 1943 was something of an unexpected nightmare for most of the new residents. With the melting of the snows, mud was everywhere, and everyone's shoes were constantly caked with it. On some days, the mud engulfed car tires in a quicksand-like grip. By April, the population of scientists had risen to 30. Most of the new arrivals were boarded in tin-roofed plywood barracks. In the one concession to aesthetics, Oppenheimer persuaded the Army's engineers to lay out the housing so as to follow the natural contours of the land.
Hans Bethe was disheartened by what he saw.
"I was rather shocked," he said. "I was shocked by the isolation, and I was shocked by the shoddy buildings. Everybody was always afraid that a fire might break out and the whole project might burn down." Still, Bethe had to admit that the setting was absolutely beautiful. Mountains behind us, desert in front of us, mountains again on the other side. It was late winter, and in April there's still snow on the mountains, so it was lovely to look at. But clearly, we were very far from anything, very far from anybody. We learned to live with it. The breathtaking scenery compensated in part for the utilitarian ugliness of the town.
"We could gaze beyond the town, fenced in by steel wire," wrote Bernice Brody, the wife of physicist Robert Brody, "and watch the seasons come and go, the aspens turning gold in the fall against the dark evergreens.
Blizzards piling up snow in winter, the pale green of spring buds, and the dry desert wind whistling through the pines in summer. It was surely a touch of genius to establish our strange town on the mesa top, although many sensible people sensibly said that Los Alamos was a city that never should have been." When Oppenheimer spoke of the mesa's beauty during a recruiting trip to the University of Chicago, an urbane Leo Szilard was heard to exclaim, "Nobody could think straight in a place like that. Everybody who goes there will go crazy,